This is an ABC podcast.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. With the kids jingled.
I'm very pleased to say that William McInnes is back on Conversations today. William is, of course, an author of many fine books and a distinguished actor with acclaimed performances in many Australian films and TV series. But perhaps his finest and most memorable role, the one that brought enormous amounts of joy to people, was William's performance as a department store Santa, a role he undertook as a struggling drama student in an air-conditioned department store. William was promoted to the role of Santa after his compelling performance as an understudy as stand-in elf, and to this day he holds the record for the tallest department store elf in Australian history. William McInnes has written a new book of Yuletide thoughts and reminiscences entitled Christmas Tales. William McInnes, season's greetings to you, sir.
Well, Merry Christmas to you, Richard, and peace be with you.
Well, that was very liturgical, I think.
It was liturgical.
Have you ever played a priest in your long acting career?
I have. I prayed and played a priest. It was for the MTC, and I was in a confessional. And my daughter, she had a mate who her parents owned a vintage shop, and this magazine, like one of those comics, like a Marvel comic, but it wasn't. It was a story. It was the serialized life of Pope John Paul II. And I decided as a gag, I took it on stage with me in the confessional. It was a few notes from the director, but the audience thought it was very funny.
Now, this most recent book of yours, Christmas Tales, it has, yes, I think, perhaps the finest opening line of any of your books, and I'm going to quote it back to you. It begins with, "Not very long ago, one early December, I heeded the advice of Sir Isaac Newton and took myself on a walk through Brisbane's West End." Can you please explain how it was that Isaac Newton could urge you to do such a thing?
Well, I was in a play at the Queensland Theatre Company called Nearer the Gods. It was a David Williamson play. And it was about Isaac Newton and his theories. And I was King Charles
II.
The second. He had a rambunctious good life. So they needed a large barn of a man to play it, and that was me. And Rhys Muldoon was playing Isaac Newton, and I was pretty morose. I don't know why, because usually I'm a pretty even-tempered sort of elephant, but I was slightly morose. I was just missing being home, and I was going to go have a snooze because I like having snoozes a lot. But then, you know, where I slept at the Queensland Theatre, they had this room where everyone had their lunch, and you could hear what they were talking about, and I just remembered trying to sleep once, and these people, quite pleasant people, were talking about a true crime podcast, which just turned my guts. You know, I went all conservative. I can tell you that. I played a very bad reverend. I can't believe you're talking about these. So one of the quote was, "Incest, sexual perversion, and murder. What more could you want?" And I thought, I don't want to listen to that rubbish. So I was rumbling around, and old Reesey says, "Oh, go on, you big bullfoot, go for a walk. You always come back in a good mood. You always find something you laugh at." So I did, and he was playing Isaac Newton in a wig that I think he borrowed from Brian May at his peak. It was very funny.
So now, that part of Brisbane, that's where David Maloof grew up, and he says he finds that part of Brisbane completely unrecognisable from the South Brisbane of his childhood.
And especially the West End, because they've had all these high-rise buildings put in. And it's sort of brutalist concrete apartments. But I went for a wander, and I suddenly was looking at this place, and it was called the Rialto, and that's where a cinema used to be.
That was a lovely theatre. It's now a Vietnamese restaurant. I performed in there in the 1990s. It's long gone, long gone.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I thought, I can remember going here, because back in the day when it was still functioning, people would get Christian services in there. My mother used to say the no-name religion, the home-brand religions, you know. Or they'd just put niche movies on.
So when you walked past the old Rialto, what kind of childhood memories did that stir in you, William?
Well, there was a kid that had come to Humbibong, the primary school I went to, and he just sat next to me, and he invited me on a trip to South Brisbane to go see his movie. And I thought, oh, yeah, that'll be great. And he was a funny little boy. He just burped all the time, you know. He was one of those kids that had the ability to burp. There were a couple of things that were prized. If you could spit between your teeth, or if you could make farts under your arm, or if you could burp on command. And this kid could burp. He burped like some crazed cartoon character.
I knew a kid that could burp the national anthem.
Well, this boy could burp the works of Puccini. He was the Bradman of burping, right. Let me tell you. But he was Greek. His family were Greek. And I remember my mother sort of said, oh, come on, you're off there, be good. You behave yourself in the car, you know, because those days it was like someone's family car was a universe unknown and you had to sort of respect it. It was a little Datsun. We just sat in the back and so, he just burped and his mum occasionally yelled at him. So we went there to this cinema and it was an Elvis Presley movie. It was called Clambake, where Elvis is a scientist who is also a speedboat racer and at night he's a club singer. So how's that for reality? But it was in Greek.
The Elvis movie was dubbed into Greek?
It was dubbed into Greek.
Right.
And Elvis had an incredibly deep voice. And then when he sang like Elvis. And the kid next to me was burping like a Morse code of the Titanic. And it was a Christmas thing, so the mother gave me a little blue fishing boat. And I remember her giving me this beautiful little wooden boat and sort of stroking me on the head and smiling and saying in broken English, Merry Christmas. And I thought, that's so sweet. And I remembered that when I was standing outside this apartment complex. And then I saw a store that had Joy to the World written on it, a sign. And I could remember my father, when you were little kids, you were given a sand shoe whitener. I don't know if they still make that stuff. You used to put it on your Dunlop volleys. And you'd draw on the window. And I was hopeless, you know.
Why was it that you used white sand shoe whitener? Why would you use that on the windows to do Christmas pictures?
Well, it was white and it looked snowy and you could just scrape it off. And I tried to do reindeers one year and my father said they were festive rats. He says, don't you bloody be doing those festive rats again. We'll have the bloody health inspector here. So I said, what am I going to do, Dad? And he said, I'll just point Joy to the World because it needs all the help it can get. And so I wrote that in this little spongy applicator that came with the sand shoe whitener. And the space of the window wasn't big enough for my sort of jumbo writing, and it started off big and it went really small. But the old man just sort of patted me on the head and he said, best on ground, son, best on ground. Joy to the World needs all the help it can get. And I was standing there in South Brisbane just remembering that. And, you know, Christmas is such a joyful time, but it's also a moment when you miss someone that's died and isn't in your life anymore, and your soul's just gripped by this acute sense of loss and sadness. And, you know, my parents were pretty loud, unreconstructed people in a way, but they were also really mighty people in that everyday way. And I was so riven just standing there. And I just thought to myself, I was so lucky to have been brought up by a pair of people like that and to grow up in the family I grew up in. You know, there was never one Christmas that I didn't feel like I was in a really happy nest. And that was a house that loved Christmas because in my parents' idea, Christmas was like the gift you get for a year well lived. It was a very old-fashioned idea of Christmas.
To say something like that, joy to the world, it needs all the help it can get, that's a completely lovely thing to say. But if I'm going to quote you from your book fully, I think you wrote that your dad said, joy to the world, cabbage head, it needs all the help it can get. Cabbage head, that was you?
I was the boy with 109. That's when I was trying to work out who Santa was, you know.
What do you mean you were trying to work out who Santa was?
Well, there's a 4IP guy, 4IP colour radio. My sister was trying to get on the phone to answer a question because she had made somewhat of a name for herself because she'd been on 4IP, and being on the radio in the early 1970s was as rare as hen's teeth, right? So it was a 4IP good guy spruiking Christmas sales and saying, you know, you better get down to the Blue Nazarene at Redcliffe because Santa Claus is going to be there at 3 o'clock. And speaking of Santa, Kris Kringle is going to also appear at the, you know, at about five different names. And I said to Dad and Mum, I said, who's Santa? Who's Santa and Father Christmas? You know, Father Christmas was our preferred option because Santa Claus was too American. But my father was sort of looking at me. He said, well, look at all the names we call you. Like cabbage head, banjo player, ass part, drill bit was another one. And, well, you know, that great, my nickname, my middle sister gave me, because Dad stood unsuccessfully for Parliament. He got done in, the only time he ever got close to winning an election, he got done by postal votes. And I was talking to my mother about it, and she said, oh, he's terrible, because he didn't know whether he would be good enough if he won, and then he thought he was, and he was so disappointed when he got done by those postal votes. And I said, what happened? And she said, oh, I felt very sorry for him. I was very proud of him, but I felt very sorry for him. And she paused and said, 9 months or so later, you came on the scene. And so my nickname for a while was Postal.
Postal.
Postal, yeah. So he sort of said, yeah, that's how he explained who Santa was, or Father Christmas and Kris Kringle. Because, you know, you can see, I sort of worked out that, you know, these flutterings of doubt about the man in red. And, you know, some of them you knew, like Vern Sykes, the butcher from Margate. He'd walk around in December, early December, handing out little specials from the butcher and the shopping centre down there. And he would sometimes suggest Santa. He'd put the beard on and the hat. He'd sort of have his butcher's apron on, and, you know, it was just like...
What, Santa with a bloody apron?
Yeah, yeah. And then another bloke who did the RSL was this string bean mate of my father's, who had a couple of fingers missing. And he'd sort of wave, and you saw him say, I know that's Bernie Williams, because he's got two fingers missing. But he had a stutter, so, but he was great. He was, oh, how are you, Mama? Merry Christmas, everybody.
Reading that, I was wondering what I used to think at the time about all these Santas that proliferated all around the place. I think there was a sort of an understanding was that they were stand-ins for the real Santa, but don't say anything, because you might get a present out of the stand-in Santa. That was
the stand-in Santa might come up with something for you.
He might come up with something. Can I ask you about trees? Because we had a Christmas tree that was this thing bought out of Grace Brothers department store, and it was essentially a wooden pole. It was a wooden pole with plastic legs, and it had these branches that were wire with shabby bits of silver tinsel coming off them, and you had to slot them in. Yeah. And my father would just swear like the whole time, he'd go, oh, this bloody thing, and jabbing these, because the longer ones, the longer fronds had to go in at the base of the tree and the shorter ones at the top. And then he'd no sooner get the whole thing constructed than the cat would attack it and the whole thing would topple over.
They're much handier than real Christmas trees.
They are. So what did you have? What kind of a tree did you have in the McInnes
family house? We had a series of trees that came from this big pine in the front yard. And the thing was, we'd pick a branch and that would be our tree, you know. And sometimes we'd pick two branches and splint them together. So some were very classically beautiful Christmas trees.
I can remember Catel being a major feature of Christmas time around our family, and certainly I used to get the Catel compilation albums. I can remember them in succession. Unreal, Bobby Dazzler.
Bobby Dazzler.
And they always had the picture of the Catel record selector at the back of it. I'm not sure that was such a reliable device. I'm pretty sure it would pitch over any time you started flipping the records. Were they a thing with you?
Well, I still have two. I still have two, and they still don't work. But my father had just been sifting around the presents and seen the Catel Easy Trainer, which is something you attached to a door handle and you sort of levered yourself up and down. It was an exercise system. And he was just laughing doing that. And my father was going up. And then you get there and you go, going down. And my mother was sitting in the garden going, it's alive, like Frankenstein. And I thought, man, this is the funniest, loveliest place to grow up.
Now, the greatest device Catel ever marketed quite successfully was the Catel bottle cutter kit.
Oh, yes.
Can you explain how that worked, William?
Well, I can explain how it didn't work. You sort of held the...
There was a cradle, wasn't there? A kind of a cradle.
It was a cradle you held it over, and you held it over a candle. And the candle would heat the glass up, and then you'd cut it. And its unique cutting ability would create a truly festive tumbler. You know, you had a King Brown beer bottle, and you'd lop the top of it off, and then you'd invert the neck, and you'd sort of have some sort of primitive goblet that you were supposed to, you know, sand down. We didn't sand it down, and, you know, one Christmas someone got a bit of glass in their lips and howling, and it turned out in my auntie Rita saying, oh, it's just like that Rock Hudson movie where they fed him glass. It was called The Spiral Road, and someone was feeding him bamboo shards, which were like glass. Right. And we had the Bleakley family pudding recipe. My sister got it from the Bleakleys, Bevan Bleakley, the Redcliffe Dolphin, who was a football hero. He was a member of them, but they had this beautiful pudding recipe. And the advice, the Bleakley says, that just don't skimp on the brandy and the whiskey. And my mum took them at their word, and she put so much alcohol in that thing. I remember my father, when he saw it, he said, "Hello, Halley's Comet's come back early." And then my auntie said, "Oh, it's like that weapon they used in that Charlton Heston movie to storm the castle." And so I thought, so the puddings became known as Charltons. I said, "Where's Charlton? Is Charlton ready?"
I don't know if you got this in Brisbane Redcliffe. I was a big fan at the time of Joe the Gadget Man, who used to do ads for Knockin' Kirby's in a floral apron. And he'd spruiked these kind of gadgets from Knockin' Kirby's hardware. And one Christmas, I demanded, I don't know why, I demanded I'd be given this thing called a juice tap, because he showed how it would work on TV. You'd plug a tap into the side of an orange. It'd pierce the peel.
Oh, that's right.
And you'd squeeze the orange and juice would come out. That seemed for some reason to me to be quite miraculous. And I got it. And of course, as soon as you squeeze the orange, the thing would go straight out of the piece of fruit. What kind of presents would you typically receive throughout your childhood on Christmas morning, William?
Well, I got a crystal set once, which I got from the RSL Christmas party, which was amazing. I always used to look forward to the RSL Christmas party, especially the parents' races. And they all raced, like, bits and pieces of them were missing. Like, they, I remember watching this awful bloody TV footage of me trying to act, and I was all dressed up, and I was running up and down Southern Cross Station, and I thought I was moving pretty good. And I heard the editors howling with laughter, and I stuck my head in, and I was just doing bad movie running 101. And I thought, I'm running like one of the fathers from those races. And these guys ran like that because they defended democracy and they'd beaten, you know, militarists and fascists and they'd saved Western civilization. I run like that because I'm a overweight pomps with dyed hair and shaped shoes that make me run on.
Tell me about the presents you used to like to buy for your mum at Christmas time, William.
Well, you know, there was a Coles Variety department store. The bottom level was a supermarket, and they had a ramp that went up to the top level. And then the ramp was this incredible, they should have had an escalator, but I think, you know, they didn't have the budget. So they stuck this ramp to get from the supermarket to the variety department. And I used to get wildflowers, this sort of bath thing to give my mum. And it was cheap, and, you know, she was very polite about it. But I remember there was the hardware man, Mr. Dyer, was the one. He had a little shop in Margate.
You brought a Christmas present for your mum from a hardware shop?
Well, yes. He wasn't a sort of a Hale and Hardy hardware man. He was more your considered chess master. He'd always sell you something you didn't need. And he said, "What do you want?" I said, "I'm after a Christmas present for mum." I said, "Yes, your mother." She used to like going to Mr. Dyer's. He said, "I think I've got the thing just for her." I bought her a packet of mixed washers.
Mixed washers.
Mixed washers, and I gave it to them on Christmas. And she's looking at it. She says, "Oh, thank you." But then my parents were so loud that, you know, they were sitting next to each other. The old man was just having a Christmas festive slurp. And my mum, when she got excited, she'd go, "Colin!" And it sounded like she was yelling across a paddock to him, but he was just sitting next to her. And he said, "Yes, Riss!" And she says, "I think this washer will fix the back kitchen tap." And it did. And it was like I was the hero. I was the saviour of Christmas. And Mr. Dyer's mixed bag of washers. And everything I gave her after that for years, she said, "Oh, it's a lovely, son, but it's not a magic washer. It's not a magic washer, son."
My dad used to traipse me through department stores and say, "What do you think your mother wants?"
Oh, that's the worst thing, isn't it?
And I said, well, the only thing that came to mind was watching an ad for Avionce perfume on TV, as in, "I'm going to have an Avionce night. I've been good and I've been sweet, and I'm going to..." I said, "I think she likes that." And of course, he bought it for mum, and mum wasn't going to wear that. And he said, "Oh, well, your son told me to buy it." And then another year, it was a Neil Diamond record, but that did work for her. Tell me about the year that your dad announced that the family was getting a pool for Christmas.
Well, that was big news, William, and I thought, my God, a pool. It is just epic.
Thrilling. You know?
And it turned up, and it was an above-ground job. And I said to my dad, you know, I thought it was going to be a proper pool, which is the worst thing I could have said. And he said, come on, no, don't be like that. You can't be whinging on Christmas. That's what, Christmas isn't about that. And he said, look at this. He said, this is a proper pool. And I was thinking, that's not like Centenary Pool, you know, they don't have above ground pools. And I was looking at him and he said, listen, do you like toads? And I hated toads. And I said, no, Dad, I don't like toads. He said, well, this has got a built-in toad barrier. Can you imagine breaststroking with those mangy buggers? Look. And I thought, that's pretty good. But I said, isn't it not concrete? And then he said this thing to me. He said, you don't want those bloody things, son. You don't want those bloody things. They crack. They're dangerous. Why do you think they swim so bloody fast in the Olympics? And I remembered that.
At the Olympics, they swim so fast.
Because the concrete's going to crack, because you can't trust concrete. They're never poured properly. They're done on the cheap.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. So that thought stayed with you?
So when the Munich Olympics, this teacher, my years, teacher said, what did we think of Shane Gould? Why was she swimming so fast? Isn't it wonderful? And I said, she's frightened of all the cracks. And I got sent to the bloody headmaster for talking, for lewd talk. He was an awful headmaster, this fellow. He was just a terrible man. I didn't like him at all. And he said, I'm going to write a letter home to your father. And I've sent it. So I thought, I am doomed. And I just walked home and the old man came out of the back shed. He said, you, here. And I didn't even take my port off. I walked up. He said, you've been talking blue. Which is a phrase, like, you've been talking blue. He said, I got this letter. And he said, what did you say? And I said, you know, Shane Gould swims fast because he was frightened of all the cracks. And he looked at me and when he laughed, he would just rip open the sky. And he just thought it was the funniest thing. He said, oh, son, you're just going to have to wear that one. And he got the pool and it still had this faded tinsel looking a bit ratty by the Clarkside. And he flipped the water at me and says, and you said this wasn't a proper pool. This is a gift that keeps on giving. And it was, you know.
Yes.
Which was such a sweet thing.
What kind of presents did you get for Dad?
I just bought him Bay Rum, which was this thing in the aftershave. Like, occasionally he'd go to a barber and he'd get a shave on a Saturday morning. And he always said, oh, yeah, well, I've got a cut and polish and I'm smelling up for mischief, you know, because he had Bay Rum was this sort of generic aftershave. And he'd sort of get it and he'd go, ah, a bit of mischief. Ooh, yes.
Mischief?
And just because, you know, you're going to, in his words, you doll yourself up, you know, cut and polish, and I'm ready for a night in the town. And I sort of, for 5 years, I just bought him a thing of Bay Rum, and he'd always say the same thing. And after he died, we were going through his boxes, and there was just sort of bottles and bottles of Bay Rum that had never been opened. But he wasn't. I got him, you know, I didn't know what to get him, and he wasn't very well. It was one of the last Christmases I was there with him, and I thought, oh, bugger it, I'll just get him some Bay Rum. And he wasn't very well. He had Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, and Artie Reader said he was the hamburger with the lot. And
you poor old dad.
Yeah, and I sort of gave him a bottle of Bay Rum, and my mum said, what do you think of that, Colin? And he was trembling, and he just said, oh, a bit of mischief. And he just sort of winked a little bit. Mate, I nearly died. I nearly cried. It was the best Christmas present. We all think we're going to be here forever, but as my dad always said, we're just passing through.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app. Or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
What kind of presents would you typically get on Christmas Day, William? I would often get like a golden breed striped T-shirt and once I recall a pair of Amco Viennese jeans.
Amco Viennese jeans.
No, V-knees, because they splayed at the knee into a flare. They were a bit too much of a flare for me, as I recall.
So I've got a pair of Bogarts.
Bogarts!
For
as I recall, Bogarts were upmarket gabardine slacks, and the pitch in the advertising for them was that they don't make your voice squeak. That was the tagline, as I recall. Were they a particularly comfortable pair of strides, William?
They were not particularly comfortable in any way, shape or form. They had the shallowest pockets that nothing but not even a 10-cent piece would fit in there. And they had a very tight crotch. They would ride hard. They were terrible pants.
What kind of Christmas stockings did the family hang?
Well, we had stockings. We had some of my mum's old stockings. You didn't have those sort of ornamental felt things. They were just Christmas stockings. And it was miraculous because these old drecky things would sort of be at the end of the bed and then they'd swell with all these things. And I would just think this is just the most wonderful day because look at all this stuff in this squeezed into this stocking. And, you know, we'd get things like an orange. I think I used to love that idea of getting a big orange in your stocking and then pickled onions. We always got pickled onions.
You got pickled onions for Christmas?
Oh, my God. Look, we used to get the Meyer hamper. That was in itself was a thing, you know. You'd get your hamper and your parents would pay a little bit of money each week to or months to get this thing and then it'd arrive. This big blue box with the blue Meyer writing on the side and we would open it like drunken pirates opening up a treasure chest. And there was this one Christmas where two arrived. There'd been a mistake. And, you know, it was like, if someone's missed out, it's not our fault. Let's dive in. And my mother said, oh, two large jars of pickled onions, what a Christmas this will be.
You have a wonderful background in Christmas performance in various department stores around Australia, in Perth and in Sydney, William. While you were studying drama in Perth, you took on a job as one of Santa's elves. Now, this seems unlikely to me because you're not petite, are you, William?
No, I'm even when I was in fighting form, I was a large human being. But when I was at Whopper, I was very friendly with some ballet dancers. And Claudia was a beautiful ballet dancer, and she's a lovely woman. And she had a job Christmas night, Thursday night shopping, late night shopping in Perth, and she couldn't make it because she had to go to the State Ballet to do a special class. And she said, my friend William can be the stand-in elf. And I went there, and the woman who is the manager of the shopping centre was just like, she spoke like Sybil Fulty, you know, hello, how are you? And she just burst out laughing. And then I went in to meet the other crew. She said, you can get into your costume there. And there was this sort of round woman who was a woman called Gretchen, who was she was Dutch. She was in an elf costume. And then there was this really thin little Santa who had an intense gaze. And he had a voice like that. He talked like that all the time. He said, where's Claudia? I said, Claudia's doing a class. I'm a friend. She said I might be able to help. And he said, so how do you like Claudia? How do you like Claudia? I said, she's a ballet dancer. You're not a ballet dancer. No, I'm a drama student. Oh, you're a drama student. You're big for an actor, big for an actor. This guy had the best name. He said his name was Langton Grayson. It's like an old Southern senator from the West Wing. But he was an intense guy and quite eccentric. And he was the Santa. He thought I was a police officer because I was so big. So I said, listen, mate, I'm not a cop. He said, oh, only a copper would say that. Only a copper would say that. You're not a copper. You're not a copper. And I said, no, I'm not a copper. I'm a drama student. And so then he padded up and we went out into Thursday night shopping and it was just scrunchies and high-waisted stonewashed jeans.
What were you wearing as an elf?
The elf costume wouldn't fit me because I was too big. I had the elf ears and I had my elf cap and I was wearing a Hawaiian shirt and King G shorts and thongs. So I was going along to Vern Sykes, you know, the Margate Santa, just suggesting Santa. And he was wild, old Langton.
Why was he worried that you might be a police officer as an elf?
Well, you know, when he settled down, he said to me, I can't be too careful. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I've done things. I'm an activist. He would say things, political things, you know, green things, political things. I don't want to say any more. So you had to sort of sit in the throne for 15 minutes and then you'd preamble around the shopping centre. And Christmas tree came on. You know how those awful tinny Christmas carols, you know, Christmas tree, oh, Christmas tree, oh, Christmas tree. He sang Keep the Red Flag Flying.
Oh, he was a communist.
I think he was. He knew that. And then, you know, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. He sang, and people were applauding because I think Santa's singing. And he sang, Have Yourself a Marxist Little Christmas. We wish you built wealth and capital. He was a very strange man. But
what an interesting spectacle it was to have communist Santa with his 6'4" elf sidekick. How did you get a job as Santa?
Well, as all great adventures begin, it was over a liquid breakfast with my housemate, who was also an unemployed actor at the time, and he made a bet saying, whoever gets the job today gets a carton of grog. And I looked through the Daily Telegraph, and there was an ad there that said, urgently required, Santa Claus, and it was in Grace Brothers, Liverpool. And I went off to Grace Brothers, caught the train from Bronte to Liverpool, took forever, got in there, and I had this meeting with somebody, and she spoke like this. What makes you think you have the ability to be one of the better department stores of Australia's Santa? And I thought, oh, I'll just muck around. She's talking like I don't speak English, and I just went, me be good Santa, me believe I'm Santa Claus. She looked at me, picked up a phone and said, he was the only one. Hung up and she went, congratulations, you've got the job. You are the new Santa Claus. And I was terrible, all right? I freely admit I was a terrible Santa. I just started going out with Sarah Watt. I just met her. This is the woman who was going to become my wife. I took her out to lunch, which was a miracle. It was at Chinatown. It was a $5 soup in Chinatown. And I said, I have to ask you a question. And she was thinking, well, you know, this is pretty full on. We've only just started going out. I said, can you give me $20 so I can buy some gumboots so I can get this job as Santa? And she just laughed and said, sure, this relationship is going to be fantastic. And she visited me and she sort of saw me on the throne. She loved misadventure, Sarah. She just loved when things went pear-shaped and just riding it. But she was also very shy and reserved, and she just gave this little wave. And I saw her, and I went, you beauty, I'll have a bit of fun here. And I just jumped up from my throne. And for some reason, they always made the Santa's throne near intimate apparel for women. I think the idea was that, you know, kids would be taken care of and they'd buy some of Burley's best. I jumped up, ran after Sarah, collected a few bras on my way, and was screaming like a loon, Merry Christmas, you, I will go on a cuddle, give me a cuddle. And they must have had a problem with their Santas, this store, because one of the security officers asked Sarah, is that Santa bothering you? And she said, yes. And I got tackled like Trevor Gilmeister tackling someone in a State of Origin match. And I was led off to a room and I was sat down and I was told, keep your hands where we can see them and don't take off your beard. I'm sitting there going, oh, Christ, what's going to happen here? And some came in and they all the managers talk slowly. What is going on? And I said, she's my girlfriend and I was just having a bit of fun. I'm sorry. She is your girlfriend? And I nodded, and then Sarah said, yes, I'm his girlfriend. She just burst out laughing, you know. The other person who came to visit me when I was on the job there was my flatmate, because he couldn't believe it. He had brought a camera. He wanted a photo with me. But he'd stopped off at a pub along the way, and he picked up a travelling companion who was, Richard, he looked like someone who just sort of attacked a monastery. He was on a Viking boat. I didn't know who he was. And old Ratch didn't know who he was. He said, he's his blazing mate with me. But they were wasted. And then by Santa's throne, my friend Ratch, he fell asleep. But the guy from the pub, who looked like a Viking, sat down, was rolling a cigarette, and he's staring up at me going, you are Santa. You are Santa. I believe in you. And then he started singing, we wish you a Merry Christmas, we wish you a Merry Christmas. And then for some reason, he merged it with Duran Duran's Girls on Film. So it went, we wish you a Merry Christmas, we girls on film, girls on film. And then he started singing all these other Christmas carols to the tune of Girls on Film. Like, you know, Silent Night, Jingle Bells.
How stoned were these guys, William?
They were whacked, Richard. They were whacked. Their idea was to get me stoned. I just stopped going into work one day because I got a job on a television show called Country Practice where I married the vet, or the ranger, I think. It was the ranger I married. I was brought in. I was a paleontologist who was digging up a rare dinosaur in Wandon Valley, as things go that way in Wandon Valley.
And, it's faintly plausible.
Yeah. So we went to Paddington RSL when it shone on TV. All my mates were there and we sat in the big ballroom there that they used to call Bingo, and that big TV screen. And I came on, and I was just abysmal. I looked like one of the Tracy boys who'd gone into acting instead of, you know, International Rescue. I was terrible. And then my final scene was I was dressed in the sky blue suit, and then I had a ruffle up the chest that was sort of secondhand Engelbert Humperdinck. It was a mix between one of his collars and a can of that whale cream that, you know, they put on cream buns. I was awful, and I was looking, thinking, I can't make a living out of acting. What have I done? And there was silence, and one of my friends went, geez, Will.
Just finally, there is a lovely story. in your book about a bloke from an assisted living centre near your place. Tell me how he came to give you a Christmas prezzy one day.
Oh, you know, I was just walking along. It was some time ago and I was trying to finish a book and I was trying to decide whether to do these plays or this television series, and I was just sort of hassled and I didn't want to do it, and I, you know, I was just a foul mood, and it was Christmas and I went, oh God, and I've got all this rubbish to deal with. And there's an assisted accommodation place from where I used to live in Melbourne. West Footscray was a pretty funny little suburb because it allowed people an elasticity and an acceptance of eccentricity and just being, and it was, you're all right, you belong here. It was a suburb with a generous soul. And I was walking past this guy and he had a bottle and he was looking at me. And I thought, oh, that's a bit weird. And this bloke, he said, here, look. And he had a soft drink bottle, his empty soft drink bottle. And he said, look through it. And I picked it up and he said, look at the sun. And I looked at the sun and it was like a kaleidoscope. And you turned it round and it was quite frankly beautiful, and it was magical. And I just laughed a little. And this guy said, be happy. Merry Christmas, yours.
How lovely.
I tried to give him some money and he said, no, laughter's enough. And I thought, that's a gift, man. That's a gift. And I, you know, when I moved out of that house, and it's a tough thing, man, moving out of the home where your children are born and where Sarah died there. And it was just a hideous, awful wrench to move. And after a while, you had to skip and you just go mental and you throw all this stuff in there. And I was going through my study and I found the bottle, I kept it. And I thought to myself, of all the Christmas presents, of all the sort of random kindness, that's one of the most beautiful things. And I just thought, there's no such thing as random kindness. This is good citizenship, good humanity. That's a myth, random kindness. And what that guy exhibited was something so precious and shone with such luster. It just put such a big jump in my step. And I never saw him again. And I'll never forget him, though. And I'm actually looking at it now, that old soft drink bottle.
You still have it?
Oh, I could not give it away. I couldn't just put it away, which is a bit weird, I know, but it's just sort of this bits of flotsam and jetsam that was given to me by another human that, well, I don't want to get all sort of too sooky over it, but it was just a little touch of magic.
It's a wonderful story. I wish you the very best for the season, William, and a happy Christmas to you, dear man.
Well, peace to you. And all that sail in you, as my mum used to say. So I don't know what that meant, but it's always a pleasure talking to you. You're a good man, Richard. I want you to have a nice Christmas too. I'll bring you a gift wrap record selector.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.